Hello, this is Peter Davison. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up.
Welcome to episode 428 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we've been sent a lovely set of bracelets from an anonymous listener and can't wait to try them on. I'm Julie.
I'm Kier.
I'm Haley.
And I'm Jay. This week, the console room is crowded again as the Fifth Doctor gets all of his kids conscious and back to England, 300 years early, in the visitation. That's not the entire problem, though, of course. As the contemporary locals are being mind-controlled by a rather amphibian-looking megalomaniac who just carried out a prison break.
This is essentially an alien invasion story, but it does have a few unique points to play with.
Yes. So for starters, the companions this time around play a varying range of help versus harm in the process of foiling the plans.
The sonic screwdriver gets outright destroyed. This was actually something John Nathan Turner had been planning to do for a while.
And of course, there is the rather gruesome final scenes that sees our villains thwarted in a way that, well, history has record of to this day.
Shoot him if he moves. Now, turn around. Drop the sonic device.
Isn't my day, is it? I feel as though you've just killed an old friend.
It is with some sadness that I tell you, you are about to join it.
Why not smile and let me live?
If I did that, you would be more of a menace than all the primitives on this planet.
You overestimate me.
And then there would be the argument over the TARDIS. You would have made a useful ally.
When it comes to visitation, as we mentioned in the intro, we now kind of have the band back together, right? Everybody's no longer getting demon entities out of their head. Nobody has been spending any time getting decompressed in some sort of a stasis chamber.
They're not actually returning Tegan to her time.
So as a result, we have, we've got a particular portrayal of the Doctor from Davison that I'm curious to ask everybody about. Did you notice a little bit different persona from our usually very affable, just, oh, you silly kids, kind of dismissive Doctor?
He seemed a little on the, little tetchy at times.
That's a good word for it, yeah.
I'd call him downright grumpy.
Yeah, like breaking pieces off the TARDIS console. And, the whole first 10-minute, it felt like about 10 minutes. That would have been half the first episode. But I'd say it was at least about 6 minutes of screen time in that opening console room scenes where Tegan is just needling him, and he's going from the eye rolls into the furrowed brow into the just get out of the room kind of, you know, if he could have put her in detention or something. I don't know.
I don't feel like she's in the wrong. If you've been promised so many times after being in very scary situations that you're going to be taken home, and then you continue to find that You're just being dragged across the universe.
How many times has she put that uniform back on? Saying, this is the day, going back home.
Even if it's just for the amount of buttons.
So many snaps.
So many snaps. Yeah. But I guess I'm still trying to determine for myself whether this was a result of something that was actually sort of written into the script by Eric Saward, or whether it was something that Davison was doing as an actor's choice, given where he knows the relationship is between these four players at the moment. Tegan is really cutting at him at every opportunity. Like, she will not let a conversation exchange go without throwing some kind of jab. Nyssa's just sort of chiming in as she needs to, but she's trying to be helpful, and at the same time she's trying to play all sides at once. Yeah. As long as it's not Adric's side.
You could even feel it a little bit more when it was just Nyssa and the doctor, and he even called Nyssa, or he said something to her to the effect of, you're trying to be Tegan on me, why stop that, this isn't fair.
Yeah, I'm already getting it from this side, I don't need it from you too.
Yeah, which kind of plays at them in different directions too. So you're seeing I don't want to call it like a breaking of the fellowship or whatever, but you're sort of seeing them cracking, like you're saying, but in different ways. There's no negative feelings, I don't think, between Tegan and Nyssa. They're actually becoming quite close and starting to share a little bit more.
True.
And so, I mean, Adric's just kind of all out there on his own because he's Adric, and he continues to make choices for himself. But the doctor and Tegan for sure have maybe most of that animosity.
She's just the most willing to articulate it. Well, she's got the most need for some specific result. Right? Nyssa's traveling for the sake of traveling. Adric is traveling for the sake of escaping.
I don't think he knows what he's really doing.
I don't know. Well, all right. Do you feel that there was any change in Adric as a result of him getting, well, first of all, kind of dressed down at the beginning? Like, he had everybody ganging up on him saying, no, you were an outright prick for jumping into that thing and thinking you could control it. Well, I was only trying to do the right thing. Well, you screwed up, and you screw up a lot because you're not really thinking first. And then he did the kind of the, you know, hands in his pockets, oh, shucks, you guys are always picking on me, Charlie Brown routine. But I don't know whether that actually carried beyond that scene. I don't know if he acted any differently in the rest of the story to follow.
Yeah, it did seem kind of almost superfluous. I mean, it was, all right, they were tying it back into the last story. And then they did it again with Tegan talking about, you know, her possession thing. So it was kind of that way to, like, we're continuing the story, but it really didn't seem like it. I don't know, maybe I wasn't looking for it. I mean, he did have that moment later on in the story where he's like, oh, I shouldn't have said anything about the TARDIS, you know, and, like, that felt a little, like, I don't want to say character growth, because that might be giving him too much credit, but it, but there was that moment of recognition for him.
Right, but too late.
Yeah.
And that's just it. Are we going to have a couple of instances of him kind of catching it in the rearview mirror going, oh, shouldn't have done that, shouldn't have done that, they told me about that. And he's not really learning, he's just able to spot it in hindsight more effectively than he could before. That's not helpful.
I mean, to that point, he did that at the very beginning. You got a 1 second, well, I don't even know if she likes me very much. Like, you think? Really? You had a SmackDown drag out fight and she punched you in the face a couple episodes ago.
Yeah. Well, so if the doctor's temper is justified, And maybe it is sort of a mix of both things. It's a matter of some of it has been written into the dialogue because of the fact that I look at it as they haven't caught a break in however long of their chronological time has passed since the four of them really got rolling. I mean, there's no, like, silly romp episode or story going on here at all. It has been crisis to crisis to crisis to crisis. And
they need to go on holiday.
They do. And Tegan just wants to go home, but I think she could benefit from a little bit of R&R too before she goes and works her shift at the airline.
Can you imagine?
Of her showing up 30 minutes before her flight departs, and she's got all this stuff rattling around in the back of her head. Oh, she's going to be right on her game.
Still worried about being possessed, you know, like you do.
A little twitchy when they ask for biscuits. And mm-hmm.
She's just snapping that jacket up in her sleep.
Exactly. Well, we get ourselves to Heathrow, or what should be Heathrow if Tegan stakes a claim on the land and makes a small fortune when they finally buy it off her.
She definitely should do that.
And all of our locals who look like, to steal a line from Bill and Ted's, it looks like the cover of Led Zeppelin's 4 album. So you got your stick carrying dude, you got your Miller, and so forth. And they're all acting a little hinky because we find that there are some other forces at play, including Discobot.
I really appreciated the detailed shinies
that had been placed. Dazzled android.
I mean, that's what you
this
get.
This is
when
Marvin's
you...
counterpart.
It's what you get when you buy your androids off of a circus tent recycler.
That's right.
Did it remind anybody else of Michael Jackson a little bit? Just
little
me?
Bit. Well, a little bit. Yep. Had the rhinestones in all the right places, decked out all in white. Liked to wear a lot of capes and masks. Sure. Got it.
I loved that mask and that it was seen as death.
Oh, well, that's true.
With the scythe and...
Well, here's the thing. I mean, there's... give credit where credit is due. Eric Sayward was really cognizant of the fact that he chose a specific era where he wanted to be able to work some historical knowledge along with a tiny, tiny little bit of scientific voodoo. There was so little science in this, it was ridiculous. I mean, from the brick wall, it wasn't a brick wall... to the power packs that charge everything. There's like a universal AA battery, apparently, for everything used in space. It's a space AA.
You also got a little bit of anti-tech with the guns because they had to fill them each time, and they were very overt about, oh, I can't fire my gun. There's nothing in it because I didn't have time to stop and fill it up.
That's right. You mean the flintlocks?
Yeah.
And there's also, but take just the fact that just the identification of the fact that there was alien species involved here, and the doctor realizing that there was this gas that could be smelled in the air, and they could trace it to the source. Before we even get to see the pteroleptals, and we're just dealing with the android alone, the fact that the android. Well, for the slow plodding way that it takes shots at people, I don't know how long that recharge cycle is before it takes another shot. It felt like about a minute and a half every time it geared up to try to take a blast at somebody. But the disguise as the Grim Reaper goes along with the fact that there was such a predominant fear at the time. We're dealing with the era of the Black Plague, so the figure of death was being used on the regular as part of the means of getting the word to people that there was massive casualties through a huge swath of the population that was really not taking an equivalent toll, to see if this sounds familiar with everything we've been going through for the past 18 months, on the nobility versus the poor. So a bit of a lean towards those who couldn't afford or didn't have the means for the same sort of hygiene, septic systems, running water, sanitary methods. So it was predominantly something that would take out the poorer or closer proximity populations. Using the idea of scaring the locals into submission by having the figure of death walking through occasionally was far better than putting any sort of other ghouly ghosty kind of image out there, or even just letting this sparkly freaking robot wander around and just to convince people that they were seeing a demon. You chalk it up to anything that you wanted, because this seemed to be more effective in kind of curbing that. I don't know. I think that's an effective little scripting tool there. Plus, it also allows you to be able to just barely see the mask behind the mask, which was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a fun idea, and it took me, honestly, like, it took me a minute to be like, oh no, that's the same android. Like, I was thinking it was two, like, it was likely two androids, and one of them was, didn't dawn on me until it later than I would like to admit that it's like, oh, it's in the, never mind.
There you go. You were prime audience. There you go.
It was very crafty at removing the mask when needed to be identified.
Mm-hmm. Interesting choice, though, that they gave it no means of, it was completely silent, like not even a whir or a click or a beep or a nothing, right?
Mm-hmm. Just a foot shuffle.
A foot shuffle and a giant kaboom when Nissa works at the
shattering
pieces.
Kaboom.
An earth-shattering kaboom, of course.
Earth-shaking.
But I gotta say, everything that happens... Yeah, shaking, right? Sonic disruptor kind of thing. The runaway with this entire thing is our rogue.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's really nothing else to this. This is...
All of my favorite lines were his. I do not understand these words. What are these things of which you speak?
Okay, you made a big point of calling that out, and I want to credit you for that, because that's absolutely the point Julie made when hearing him say that, you know, questioning the words that are being spoken, the conversation that's being had, where he's the third person in the room, and there's a far more technological exchange going on around him. And what did you remark on?
I think it was just basically that he, even if he understands the language and the words that are piecing it together, he doesn't understand what they're talking about at all. And I feel like that's not always something that gets brought up or pointed out. And right. I loved it that it happened not just once either, that there were multiple instances where he would be like, what?
Yeah. You need to have more of the NPCs call you out on the fact that you're using a bunch of gobbledygook. That, I'm sorry, if I'm standing in a room and people are speaking in using references to things that they both think are totally commonplace and I have no idea, I'm going to ask, what are you referring to?
And I think it was even like a colloquialism where he's took it to mean the literal, and he's like, you can't do that thing.
Right. Yeah.
I just, my favorite.
Yeah. Plus, his voice is just fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole idea of him, a street performer who has turned to sort of highway robbery just as a means of getting by, and yet you don't really think he was probably that good of a performer in the first place, other than the fact that he just likes to put on big airs and wave his hands around a bit.
I would bet for the time that he was pretty good, because he could command the audience.
Yeah, he has a watchable quality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's just in a town that's just a bunch of... It's a really tough room. It's a tough room.
Yeah. Well,
everyone's,
I mean,
wearing bracelets.
He understands the humor and the people that he's around. And so I feel like he would read the room and then tell them the jokes they needed to hear about them walking through the woods or whatever. And then, because he fit in with our crew.
Yeah.
Which, had he not been that kind of person, they wouldn't have trusted him. He convinced them very quickly that he was not, he's up there for a reason, but it's not what they think, and follow me to my secret barn. Mm-hmm. And then kept saying, I'm going to go do my own thing. And they kept bringing him back into the fold. As the watcher of this, I feel like that is the kind of person that just fits in wherever he might be.
It's not often that we get a third party, a non-companion who is worked this much as the glue. Very seldom. And I think a lot of that might be dependent on, as much dependent on the script as any given writer's comfort level with taking the limelight away from your TARDIS team proper. If they're supposed to be the ones that are the prime movers in pushing the story forward, you just want the background characters to be there to give some dimension, right? But you don't necessarily want to hand them the joystick, necessarily. he at times is one where, well, because he establishes himself as this figure of authority, you know, he's got this fascinating, really, really wonky moral compass that I'm still trying to suss out, because he is a rogue, mm-hmm. you know, and he is self-serving, and he will probably, you know, do some less than reputable things for his own gain as needed. But we don't see him. Like, you get the impression that he's, you know, always looking out for number one.
But he won't take the Miller's horse and carriage.
He won't take the horse and carriage. He won't break into the house.
Right.
No, the doctor does that.
Yeah. He's offended at the fact that they did.
But once he's in there, he's, well, might as well drink this. Might as well take one of these. These guns look pretty nice.
Yeah, he just wants a good bottle of sack. That's all.
They're not here anymore, clearly.
It's really funny. It's like... I'm trying to think of like the high school equivalent of the kid in the clique who wasn't usually the instigator, but as soon as things started to go a little hinky, he was along for the ride. You know? Oh, okay. Well, you know, you've already broken into your dad's car. We might as well take it around the block.
Exactly. He's the girl from Dairy Girls who's like, I just want this noted that I do not agree, but I will do it anyways.
Exactly. an unwilling accomplice, but an accomplice nonetheless. I don't know. I just find it fascinating. I'm really glad that they... I'm still trying to wrap my head around where they left him as far as his decision that he wanted to stay and be of help as the fire breaks out, which we'll get to in a second. But I'm trying to see if there's some sort of a character significance. Has he gone through a bit of an arc himself?
I think that he sees some kind of bounty or reward for saving, being the first man on the on the fire scene to start putting it out, direct
rubbing some
traffic.
Soot on his cheeks to say, yes. Oh, I was in the mix of the thrall of death at all times.
The whole place would have gone up without me.
Right.
Flames to the left of me, embers to the right.
Yes, that he was the one who told the story afterwards.
Exactly. Well, and
so not every only did he get the award or whatever for being there and helping, but he also got all the bard money afterwards for telling the story far and wide.
He got the book deal, yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Yes.
Well, that tees us up for the fact that this was specifically set in 1666, so that if you didn't pick up on some of the little references that are placed as we get towards the end, the fact that we're in a bakery, the fact that it's on Pudding Lane, that this is believed to be the point of origin for the Great Fire of London.
So, have we been talking about those fixed points in time?
Note for the record that this is not the first time that the Doctor has been responsible for a massive arson incident in European metropoli. If you go back to the Romans, even though it was it's lost episodes, the Doctor was responsible for that fire as well. My question is this morally a good thing for the Doctor to have done? There's a reason why I ask. There is an argument as to whether or not the Great Fire of London was responsible for helping quell the spread of the Black Plague, because it basically burned such a huge swath of some of the more impoverished sections of London that it killed a bunch of the rats and therefore kept the rate of infection down. So it was somewhat credited for all of its destruction, but it was also massively destructive and threw the nation into economic tailspin for decades.
But only six people died.
Only six right. people died.
Yeah.
So, well, died as direct result of the fire. So the economic impacts and the impacts on trade and everything else with the vibrancy of the city in the years and decades that follows, you get to start playing around with, well, was this really the best thing for the Doctor to do? Or it was completely out of their hands and it's just something you can't do. A fixed point in time.
I was going to say, like, that's the silver bullet right there with Doctor Who, is it's just call it a fixed point in time and all of a sudden all of the ethics and morality gets swept away. It's like, nope, couldn't have interfered regardless. You can't do anything about it. So it's, we could sit here and postulate all we want, but at the end of the day, it's like, this is the script we were given, and that's, if that's how they want to explain it, then, you know, we can't really sit there and argue.
Mm-hmm.
How else would they have dispatched with these aliens, with the Terraleptals?
You could have put out the fire after killing all of them.
Yeah, they had the opportunity, and the doctor basically said, let it burn.
Yeah. And they wouldn't have melted so gloriously.
Wow.
They wouldn't have popped a little bit.
That
I was very disturbed.
Yeah.
Well, here's... The Terraleptals, in general, I think, were a beautifully built villain. Like, this is the first time you're starting to see some of the prosthetics on the mask work and stuff where there's facial expressions. It's not just a flappy mouth.
Right, just the lips moved.
Yeah, you've got lip movement. You've got, I think, even the brow furrowed. Mm-hmm.
The teeth were creepy. Like, those teeth did not go with that mouth.
True. And it was pronounced by the fact that our lead Terraleptal was the one who suffered the prison break injury, so you could see all up the left side of his mug there. Kind of gross. Like,
yep.
They played him like he could see out of both eyes, though.
Yeah.
You're going to give like this poor...
He was looking straight up. Look, if Fury has to turn his head to see over there, then this Terraleptal needs to turn his head to see over there.
His eyes are even farther apart. He should have to turn. He should be pivoting.
But he's amphibious, or, you know, he's got the froggy eye, so it's probably...
Yeah, right, but it only goes to front. Like, you can't see the hand gesture. Side to front. That's his range of motion on the eye.
And a very angular, like, face, so you can't see on the other side of your face from the right side.
There were very few instances where he was playing ping pong or trying to do anything where he had to look anybody directly in the
eye. How hilarious would that have been, though? Like, somebody drops something on the other side of the room and he has to turn all the way around to see it?
Oh, I see you've dropped that thing.
They just keep dancing around in his blind spot. Oh, that's good. That's a whole ableist section of comedy in this entire...
Ooh, I now understand why it took the android so long to turn and fire. It was being driven.
Oh, jeez.
Just saying.
So he was wearing a VR kit and only one side of the VR mask worked? Oh, come on. This is getting
worse. Both sides of the VR mask worked, just not both sides of his face.
Yeah. Right.
But if you think about it, the Terraleptal was driving the locals that had on the wrist
by
watches.
Using the weirdest control panel I've ever seen. All it was just a bunch of metal bars, and he's looking at it and determining all this information.
Turn them on. I mean, I think they said it was something about telepathy, and they had these thoughts about what they needed to do.
But my favorite part of all, with all of the work they put into the escape pod, like, that was beautiful. When they go down, they step down into the escape pod, that whole set was gorgeous.
Yes, right? Yeah.
For something that they had to construct on a soundstage. The location work that they did was great. You know, guys up in trees and people running around in fields, and that's all absolutely fine. And then you get into the control room where the Terraleptal is standing there, and he's going through... maintaining all these things. The doctor gets in there and needs to disable it. He picks up a panel, pulls out a chip. That's the whole thing. That's like Obi-Wan taking out the entire Death Star by pulling down one lever. There you go. I found that hilarious. And then he hands it to Mace as a keepsake. Here.
Thought you might like this shiny thing.
Yeah, go sell it because you know you will.
Yeah. I was also taken aback by how easy he just walked over, not even having to figure out where it was from, just walked over to it and was like, lift, grab. It's like a...
Didn't unscrew anything.
Instead of silverware.
Yeah.
Couldn't find the knife in the silverware drawer. Just pick that up, grab that out. There it is.
This piece looks important. Let me grab that.
Yeah, you're not going to need that, are you?
This one was raised up by millimeters, so I figured, you know, the control panel was under it.
Well, you had even caught the fact that he name-checked the Terraleptals very early. Mm-hmm. Like, they walk into the escape pod, and they're kind of looking around, and he's saying, oh, you know, it's illuminated by these crystals. Whoever crash-landed here does this, that, and the other. And then all of a sudden, it cuts away for a scene, comes back, and he... Quick name drop.
I think it was probably the nature of the crystals, the ship, and the solid whatever gas.
Yes.
soliton gas. I think that is what cued the doctor in, because he said he knew that they needed it to survive, and right. That's why they were huffing it at the end.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. I do like the fact that there were like three different colors of them too. It was made it very easy to tell them apart. Cool looking costumes. I like it. I've never seen anybody cosplay them or do. I'm sure there are probably still a few collectible figures out there for them. I'd get one. I think they're cool.
You could wear a mermaid tail as the bottom and just walk
around. Yeah. I think basically, you know that plastic that they do for pool covers?
Yeah.
That's kind of what they had wrapped around them on the outside. So I'll just get some colored pool cover plastic.
That sounds breathable. It's going to be cozy to wear all day.
The last thing I wanted to check with you all on was the fact that, as Haley mentioned, the Sonic is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really abruptly. Like, he uses it once or twice. Chandler gets it out of his pocket, throws it down on the ground, blasts it, done. Melted into a taco. And that's just it. And I think the doctor says something like, oh, that's really unfortunate kind of a thing. Doesn't really get to
I think he called it an old friend.
Something to that effect, yeah.
Yeah.
So Turner had wanted to phase it out because he felt it was getting to be too much of a shtick. It was
like a shtick?
It was a shtick. Like my dog carrying around a shtick. No, it was a get out of jail free card. And it was a writer's cop out.
What would he think of Tenant?
Exactly. Well, that's my point.
Hey, to be fair, Doctor did not try to use it on the wood to get them out.
Because it doesn't do wood.
I know.
They could have established that right there and then.
Canon way back.
Yeah. But
was anybody sad by it being gone?
It was being particularly... Well, but now that we've been doing this chronological rewatch, do you feel like, I guess all things being relative, do you feel like it was being overused at all?
I personally, no, because I came to this through New Who. So I remember us making complaints about, Matt Smith waving it around like a magic wand. Like that's part of what it is. So I was already conditioned to accept it as such. So I don't know. If I had started from the First Doctor and moved my way through, maybe I'd feel different, but that's not my experience. So it's hard for me to say.
Yeah, I'm in pretty much the same boat as Jay, and honestly, I expected to see a new Sonic soon, but I know that we don't because I read the TARDIS wiki about it, but I would not expect this to be this is the last we're going to see of the Sonic for a while.
Right. I get it. I mean, I felt the same way about the Sonic in modern utilization, too, that it was a matter of it was getting to... In Tenant's era, it was going to be, okay, all right, that's quite a toolkit you got there. You got that. You're using your psychic paper fairly often and so forth. And I wanted more clever outs for the situations that you were being put in. And then in 11's era, it just went through the roof. At that point, I just pushed back and said, somebody please destroy this thing. Please, please, please take this thing out. And it led us to even have the conversation during Capaldi's era about whether or not the Sonic Shades was just a matter of, all right, do you really need to start creeping this back into? Or are we just going to get into yet another toy? Mm. Is this becoming James Bond in space? So,
James Bond never had a guitar.
Never had a guitar. No. And James Bond never had space floof. Anyway, off topic. Yeah. So, in general, how did the story leave you? Start to finish, I mean, you're dealing with, with a thwarted alien invasion that just happens to start a massive torching of one of the largest cities in modern civilization. How was the visitation as a tale?
I'd have to say that I probably will wind up rewatching this one simply because of Mace. The rest of it is... is fine. It's a fairly, middle of the road Fifth Doctor story, I think. But I would go back and watch this over and over again just because Mace is so fantastic as a character. And that, I would recommend it to people because I'm like, look, the story is, it's fine. It'll get you through whatever, but this guy makes it.
Yeah. That's very true. He definitely makes it rewatchable. Would it be something that you would tell other people as far as, you know, you want to see a really good indicative Fifth Doctor story, you would hand them something like this? Would you include it in that list?
With a caveat, depending on what they were looking for, you know, if they wanted something that was indicative of the Fifth Doctor era, probably not. But if they're just cherry picking some Fifth Doctor episodes, I'd throw this one in there and be like, it doesn't match with anything else, but this guy's worth it.
Okay.
I would rewatch it. I thought it was fun. And I think in terms of how it fits, from what we've seen so far of the Fifth Doctor, I feel like it does put him in sort of a bad, grumpy light. And I don't like it when people fight on screen when they're supposed to be the ones that I am cheering for and wanting to see them get along. So for me, that feels a little bit cringy, or I get anxious for them, like stop fighting, figure it out kind of feelings. So for those reasons, I don't love the beginning and some of their infighting stuff, but I think it redeems itself because of some of those character moments. I laughed out loud a few times, and I really do like the Tereleptal, and that it seems so much more real than what we've seen.
Yeah.
And I like the era. I think it played well for everything that they accomplished with the story.
Yeah, I agree
there.
Yeah. I really enjoyed this story, especially Mace. Like Jay said, he kind of steals the show in this one. I would like to see more of the Tereleptals. I think this story did a good job of pointing out that, you know, we saw the rogue in a group that is not all rogues. This is a more nuanced society that we don't get to see all that dynamics of. So it would be fun to see them again in a different type of story.
Good point.
They're wrapping up filming on this new season. I feel like now's a good time to bring them back, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Why not?
Producers who are listening, we have a vote on which villain should come back. Yeah.
It definitely has the rewatchability for some of just the performance factor. I would argue that it does have some qualities that would make it recommendable, because it does allow you to be able to see examples of Davison's Fifth that break out of the goody-goody teacher in the TARDIS classroom moniker that he so often gets saddled with. But it also, completely on the flip side of it, for all the reasons why the three companions get branded as such, as they respectively do, you know, Tegan being the one that gets under everybody's skin because she just won't let something go. Well, you see that in spades in this particular story. Adric being, if you want to solidify the opinion that Adric is an annoying little twat, this gives that to you. Because he's insufferable in this, you know, the petulant kid.
Won't even wait to be rescued.
No.
Like, climbs out the door.
just a jerk throughout. Yeah. But the fact that we've seen Waterhouse do other things with the character means that we already know that he's capable of something more. But this particular script kind of saddled him with Adric being, you know, 110% Adric. And Nyssa, for as long as it took her to put that device together and all the stuff she had to go through to do it, was playing to exactly what her strength is. The reason why she's here, right? She's the backup scientist and did an exceptional job of it, you know, and kind of single-handedly takes out this android that very slowly pursues her.
So, I love that the doctor came in and said, well, in theory, I just didn't think it was actually going to work.
Yeah. Wow.
Good job.
I was going to find you in pieces. Hey.
I didn't understand why Nyssa seemed so, like, despondent after she finished it. Like, it didn't look like she was exhausted. It looked like she was like, well, I did the thing. I don't know. It just, like, she seemed so melancholy, and I wasn't sure why that was.
But then you get the line from her that, for me at least, kind of brings that home. Why is she acting kind of morose about it? And then she says, this was such a beautiful creation.
Oh, okay.
You know, this was an amazing piece of work. I would have wanted to be able to kind of studied
the android?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was so shiny.
Well, it had more to do with the shiny. She's a freaking scientist.
She wanted to study it and learn how it had been built and that it did accomplish its tasks. And mm-hmm. yeah, she had to just straight up destroy it.
I apparently missed that line. But to be fair, by this point in the story, I wasn't listening to anybody that wasn't Mace.
That's true. Although I have one other point of contention. When they are running through the forest and they say, okay, we're going to go to the Miller's house, and Nyssa, you go back to the TARDIS, or you keep going to the TARDIS, and she turns around and runs where they just came from.
Yeah. There's a slight,
I was like,
slight
wait,
continuity.
I almost asked if we could go back and look again just because I wanted to confirm what I already 100% knew.
Yeah. They only had so much space on location. She couldn't run in any other direction.
Run to the camera and just knock it over.
Exactly. Yeah. You just blast right through craft services.
Yeah. And then I forgot to mention this earlier, but props to Adric and team for the very beginning when they run into the locals and Adric just straight up drops to do the push him over my back move.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He drops down on all fours behind the guy's legs so they can do the pushover move. That's so cartoony.
It happened so quickly, though, that you were like, what? Oh, he just... That worked, and then they got away, so...
He didn't even get fully into place. He was only behind, like, one of the guy's legs.
That's all it takes.
Yeah,
but
well.
His knees got dirty, and then were clean in the next scene. So, props to that department, too.
The only thing that could have been even better is if he just ran up behind somebody and dead-legged him. And ran off. Nobody expects that.
I imagine that Matthew Waterhouse is very particular about his clothing, even though it's the same outfit all the time, because we get, almost in every episode, an inconsistency over when he sits in a mud puddle and then it's dry.
Yeah.
So either that was the second take of this, or, you know, his knees were dirty and then they were clean, and I am a stickler for those kinds of details, so for me, I lose it for just a second where I'm trying to follow the story, and I'm like... Come on. It just happened.
Yeah, well, you can't shoot the whole thing in sequence.
I know.
But all right. Well, I think this is, you're going to see right now, there's actually been some things going around that the whole season 19 is getting bundled for various distribution formats. You can now, aside from all the Steelbox special features, special casing, there's now one where you can just get standard Blu-ray sets of all the remastered stuff with the extra features. So, if this is your jam, if this is the kind of stuff the sort of just enough historical relevance to make it fun and just enough pseudoscience to make it enjoyable and just enough of a crowd in the TARDIS to keep you entertained, congratulations. They are literally marketing to you as we speak from BBC Drama. So go get your stuff.
All right. Well, next week we're going to take a break from all of the rewatches, and we're going to have a bit of a discussion about the current state of, you know, what constitutes spoilers. What is too much information coming down the pike? And, you know, where do we need to draw the line?
This won't be a spoiler discussion. We're not actually going to get into some of the stuff that is being discussed in the...
Thank you.
All right. Julia, with her obligatory thanks for not ruining anything. But just a matter of look back to past seasons, look back to the way things were done just in the most recent seasons with what we've dealt with returning characters, surprise characters, returns to locations, and so forth. And just, you know, we'll have a conversation about whether it's a matter of, you know, are there certain things that fall within the, okay, well, that's fair because that's a casting thing. So you're proud the fact that you were able to land this great guest star. So, you know, maybe you want to share that, or when is appropriate. If we don't even have a release date for the season coming, should you be giving us a steady drip of some information to keep us interested?
Dan.
You know, what are the pro cons? So we're going to sit here, we're going to do T-charts the whole time.
Ah.
Yeah.
I'm good at those. Maybe I'll have something to add more than just don't tell me anything.
Except when the season's going to start. That's the one thing I really want.
That's all I want.
Give me a date in the horizon. That's all. Yeah. But yeah, I think it should be a good conversation.
All right. Well, this has been episode 428 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I'm afraid my frame was never designed for rapid acceleration.
And this is Gear saying, donkey. Oh, donkey.
And this is Julie saying, where's Kier? Oh, well, maybe he's found a wall that seems to fascinate him.
And this is Haley saying, I'm going to go rearrange the furniture in my room and put the bed right in front of a bookcase.
We'll see you next week.
Auzi.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Want to keep the conversation going? You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, or just send us a good old-fashioned email to feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also give us a phone call at 754-225-5477. That's 754-CALL-GPR, and you may hear your voice on a future episode of the show. Everything's got to end sometime, otherwise nothing would ever get started. Join us next week for a brand new episode.
Jacob Hansen. Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2021. We'll see you next week.